Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of the Kevin Rose Show. Really excited to do my second Ask Me Anything. I want to say, first of all, thank you to everyone that submitted questions to my Instagram account. I got probably, I'd say, between 500 and 600 questions, so I couldn't get to them all, but we highlighted a few of my favorites in here and got through quite a few of them, actually, because we do a rapid fire at the end. For this episode, I wanted to, a couple things. One, tell you to follow me up on at Kevin Rose on Instagram. And the second thing, I'm excited to do this episode with Jason DiFilippo. I've known Jason for a very long time now. We were old school web 2.0 geeks back in the day. Jason also edits this podcast and he's also a podcast host. If you haven't heard his show, you'll want to check out Grumpy Old Geeks. Jason, it's good to have you on the show, man.
Good to finally get together on a show at some point. It's taken a while.
I know, dude. We have been friends for... Do you remember when we first met?
We first met, I think it was right before you got funded for Dig. Because you said something really nice on TV about Technorati, and I was like employee 11 at Technorati, and I saw you at
That's right.
The Lucky Cat. Or no, the Black Cat.
Black Cat, yeah, in San Francisco.
And I just came up and said hi, and then it turned out we lived like two blocks away from each other, and... The rest is history.
Which was actually a bad thing.
Yeah, it was a bad thing.
Because we ended up becoming drinking buddies back then, and we were pretty young and foolish and consumed a lot of beer together.
We were pretty good at being drinking buddies, that's for sure.
That's right. That's right. There's some good stories in there that we shall not talk about.
Nope. Nobody will ever hear those.
That's right. So, yeah, I'm excited to do this with you. Thanks for agreeing to come on and help me out with some of these questions, because it'll be nice to have someone to chat with them about. Last time I did one, it's kind of weird when you do those AMAs and you're like the only person sitting in the room. So, yeah, it's cool to have you on the show too.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, shall we get started?
Let's do it.
Do you have any advice for a recent college graduate stepping into the startup world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this one is something that, you know, we all landed in that first kind of gig straight out of school. Or in my case, I, you know, dropped out of school. I think you were a dropout too, right?
Jason, yes, I was. Well, yeah. I mean, I went to school for photography and just kind of bounced into computers on my own. So I learned everything myself. But
yeah, you were all self-taught on the coding side. I remember that.
Yep.
You know, I think that in the early days, don't think of this as like, okay, I'm going to work my way up and be CEO in 5 years. I think it's more about doing excellent work. It's about making friends. You know, these friends will eventually, you know, go off to start other companies or join other businesses. And when you have those relationships, that's going to open up, you know, opportunities at future companies. And really, I would say these first 5 years are all about networking and improving your worth and being able to take on any task. So whatever you do, do it at the highest level and don't have this attitude where, well, that's beneath me. I mean, you really, really have to get scrappy and to show that you're willing to take on anything. And when you do that and you do it successfully, you know, the people in charge, if you're working at a good organization, will start to hand you tasks that are, you know, more and more challenging. And that will eventually lead to promotions and other things. But yeah, definitely making friends and doing excellent work would be my advice.
What's your take on specialization versus generalization in a startup?
Well, I guess it really depends on if you had gone to school for coding and you already know I'm, you know, going to be in this particular department. If you're someone like me that had taken a little bit of coding, but also loved to do, I was kind of doing some early display ad stuff when I first got started and kind of tracking down all of our conversion all the way from the, you know, the actual ad source all the way down to the network that we purchased the ad at, all the way to converting to a shopping cart and our cart abandonment rate. And I just loved Excel and loved to jump into that. So when I was at my first couple startups, it was, you know, doing a little bit of everything, just kind of trying to see what I gravitated towards and what I really loved. So yeah, I mean, if you're a coder, I would get serious about something, especially given the kind of crazy demand on the machine learning and AI side. I mean, that's a no-brainer to go into those very specific niche kind of industries early on, because in 5-10 years, you'll be making some serious dollars in those fields. I know that when I was at Google, I had heard that some of our higher end kind of AI folks were, gosh, it was over $1 million in total comp a year. for those types of coding positions, which is just insanity. But it just goes to show you how few people at that time were actually doing that work. And it was very sought after. And so they could command those salaries. But yeah, I'd say if you really don't know what's going on and you're kind of like, well, I think I like this, but I'm not sure. I mean, when you're so early in your career, you can afford to go and spend 3 years, two, 3 years at something and then end up bailing on it and saying like, I just don't like this, and then jump over to the next thing. So don't be afraid or feel like if you've gone down a path for a few years. And I wouldn't say this even as an adult, like later on in life, if you've gone down this path and you keep just beating yourself up and you know it's not for you, I don't know, man, life's too short. Just it's worth taking sometimes a few steps back to move forward.
Definitely, definitely. And on the generalization side of things, I just want to chime in that when I was at the companies, I was always a coder, but I got to know every different part of the business just because it makes you a better coder, because you know what the business goals are, you know what the marketing goals are, and it helps you align what you're doing when you design your software and you throw out ideas for new features. It really makes you more valuable to the team. And it's not that you're going to have to go, you know, you're going to be writing, you know, C, PHP, JavaScript, doing design work and all that stuff, not that kind of generalization, but just knowing, having a working, functioning knowledge of the startup that you're working in, like try and get your fingers in everything, because it's going to make you more valuable to the team in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if, like, let's say you're an engineer and you eventually want to make your way to the management track, you're going to have those skills anyway, right? Because if you're managing other engineers, part of your responsibility is not only obviously managing that team, but then also kind of working with other related teams, you know, the marketing departments, the CEO and the other organizations internally to fulfill that vision. So you're going to need to have those skills.
All right, moving on. How often do you meditate?
Yeah, I mean, that's changed quite a bit over the years. I would say that initially I kind of did it on a more prescriptive kind of thing, where I was meditating to relieve anxiety and just kind of using it because I was going through something in life where I felt like meditation would help me. And then, you know, later I realized that that's actually kind of the worst time to meditate. You really want to have a habit and build up a practice so that you don't even get in those situations to begin with. And so for me, that looks like at least, and this will seem like a very short amount of time, but at least 10 minutes, sometimes 20 minutes a day. But the key here is 10 minutes every single day. So treating this like something that cannot be skipped. Everyone can find 10 minutes. I don't care how busy you are, but just making sure to keep up that daily cadence so that it is a part of your life. And those benefits will compound over time. And I think it's all you really need. I was first doing longer form meditations, but then, you know, after when life all of a sudden hits you from a different direction, you realize, you know, I don't have time to sit for 40 minutes a day. I was doing 20 minutes in the day and 20 minutes a night. And then all of a sudden, one of those falls off, and then all of a sudden the second one falls off, and you're like, well, I got to go out and meet a friend for dinner tonight, so I can't do, you know, and then you're not meditating at all. So yeah, sticking with a daily practice that you promise to yourself internally that you just will not move or sacrifice it for anything else. And doing those 10 minutes, I think, is the key.
How has your practice changed from when you didn't have kids to when you had kids? Is that when it started to fall off?
Well, my practice has changed quite a bit in that I've studied with a bunch of different disciplines over time. I was very lucky to live across the street from the San Francisco Zen Center when I moved over on Page Street there. And I would pop in and actually took my first training in meditation with the Zen monks there and learned about Zazen and all the proper ways, the proper way to sit and how you would enter the temple and like all of these like very formal things that they have when you practice Zen. So I was lucky. And then that was an hour long meditation that I was doing there seated. But then when the app started coming out, so, you know, Headspace launched and eventually Calm came out, I started just practicing at home with a cushion there. And I was moving to 20 minutes a day, I think is pretty much where I was at. Then I started, I studied TM meditation, which is a form of mantra meditation. They recommend that you do 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes at night. That's a very, mantra meditation is a very intense thing. It's like, it's different than the Zen or more Vipassana kind of mindfulness-based meditation. And more recently, I've gotten serious about that mindfulness-based style. I think Sam Harris has a fantastic course It's a 50-day, 10-minute-a-day course on Vipassana-style meditation. I fear that a lot of the meditation apps, Oak included, the one that I've most recently worked on, they're great for an introduction, and a lot of them are really great for prescriptive stuff. So I have a fear of flying. I'm going to take a fear of flying pack and things like that. But they don't go really, really deep for people that want to take meditation seriously. So that's the one thing I really loved about Sam's course. He really is for meditation for people that want to go a little bit deeper.
If you could call yourself 10 years ago and talk for 1 minute, what would you tell your younger self?
Oh, gosh. That's a difficult one. So 10 years ago, for 1 minute, I think I would say that not a single person on earth has everything figured out, you know, quote unquote, everything figured out. And that there's no such thing as figuring out life. Believing that you can crack the code or figure it out, it's just going to cause you anxiety because you're constantly trying to figure out something that is just too dynamic to be solved. Once you surrender to that idea, then you can finally just exhale a little bit and let go. And you're actually a lot closer to peace and balance than if you're chasing something that's just impossible. And Jason, I'm sure you're in the same boat. It's like we've bumped into, living in the Bay Area, billionaires running very large tech companies, and you become friends with these people, and everyone from the outside world looking in would say, man, they have it all. They've got an assistant, they've got two nannies, they've got, you know, all of these things. They drink whatever wine they want, they fly in private jets. And you meet these folks and you realize that they're in the same boat that we're all in. Like, none of us are ever going to figure this out. There's always something that happens, that occurs, that when you think you have it figured out, life just tosses you upside down. I had a buddy of mine that sold his company to Fitbit, and he had an offer, and it was, you know, somewhere around $35 or $40 million. And as he was going through this process and signing all the docs, he gets hit with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cancer. And it's just like, you know, that's life. Yeah. That's yep. life. And thankfully he's doing fine now and he's in full remission, but it just goes to show you that this is too dynamic. When you can release and let go of that chasing, that thing that you will never obtain, it gets a lot easier.
It's funny talking about the people that we used to know that made it super big. Those people seem to be a lot more miserable now than when we used to hang out and have fun. It's like, you know, mo money, mo problems really is kind of a thing.
So here's the thing. I've seen a handful of friends that are now billionaires that I knew and we all would hang out with when we had, you know, two pennies to rub together. Mm-hmm. And every asset that you acquire, everything, like whether it's a new car, it doesn't matter what it is, everything that you take on has some type of burden, right? So a new car would have maintenance issues that might go along with it, or it might have an increased premium for an insurance, which means you have to make more money than to be able to cover that insurance. It's like all these material things are just adding mental burden. I sat down with this kind of Zen tea master when I was studying tea, he was teaching me a lot about different types of tea. And he said to me, do you want to know the key to life? And I was like, yeah, like, let's hear it. Like, sounds great. You know? and he goes, less keys. And he pulls out one key that he had in his pocket. And he goes, this is my one key. He goes, it's the key to my front door. That's all I have. And he goes, that just like simplicity of not having a second house, of not having another car, of not going out and acquiring all these things, but just, he has that one key. And he lived in the most humble little small dwelling and you know, just had his little tea collection. It was so at peace. I think we would all love to be in that place at some point. And it just, material things aren't going to get you there. You know, it's not going to create that level of happiness.
It's funny, when you and I were hanging out in San Francisco, almost everything I owned fit in my car, and that was by design, in case it's like time to go. And living in San Francisco and being around all the rich people, then they got me starting to collect stuff and stuff and stuff. And then years later, I finally purged everything again and went back to my car. I got a bigger car, but it was much nicer and much calmer. So I had the keys to my car. And I tell you what, letting go of all of that stuff that you have to carry around, as Tyler Durden would say, the things you own end up owning you.
It's so true.
Moving on to our next question. Did you struggle finding purpose post-dig?
Yeah, I think I definitely did. There was a point where when dig kind of fell apart, And our offer from Google in the very last hour, they pulled the plug on it and we didn't have the acquisition happen, where I just was in total shock. And that then snowballed into product decisions and other things that we did that just didn't make a whole lot of sense for the company, which let Reddit overtake us as kind of, you know, the biggest social news site that was out there. But I would say that there was certainly a good year or so where I was trying to kind of figure things out and trying to find purpose. But what this whole thing did, the whole collapse of Dig, what it did is it forced me into a better place by kind of forcing me into some introspection. It really forced me to acknowledge where my deficits were and the things that I didn't know that I had been trying to kind of cover up, which pushed me more into lifelong learning and admitting some of my faults and becoming a more open person. And then eventually got me into meditation. So I would say that had that sale to Google gone through, I was living kind of a crazy lifestyle back then, you know, back in the Dig Nation days and when Dig was on top, and there was this idea of, like, you know, it was a lot of drinking and a lot of just, like, I can only imagine had I had that outcome and those dollars, like, where I might have gone. And so I really like the fact that when I look back on that, I'm like, gosh, this really forced me into a much better place, because it forced me to pause and say, well, wait a second, I don't know everything and I did screw up. And why did I make the wrong decisions? And when you have to reevaluate all of that and you can embrace the fact that you were wrong and you can learn from those mistakes, it just really puts you in a better position long-term, which I'm really happy about now. So when I look back on that, I'm like, gosh, that was probably the right thing to have happen.
I miss the Dig Nation days, I gotta say. They were fun, but man, yeah, if you had lots of money, you would have had lots of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, you knew me back then.
Oh, just think of what that Reno show would have been like.
Dude, we got into enough trouble with no money.
I know.
So it's like we didn't need that on top of things. So I definitely, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I love Dig Nation and hosting that show with Alex and doing all of those fun times. It was a blast, but that was great on the entertainment side and fun side. But what you didn't see is a lot of the mistakes made at Dig, because I hadn't managed people before, because I hadn't, you know, admitted that I wasn't a good manager, because I'd never looked to find a coach to help me learn some of these things I didn't know. You know, that's the stuff that I guess I'm more talking about there. But yeah, Dig Nation was a blast.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of tools for people like you that were starting their first technology company back then. Not like there are today, because you were kind of at the spearhead of that whole thing with the whole .com generation coming through that with entrepreneurs back then.
I would say that one thing I always respected about Mark Zuckerberg, I remember when he came by the Dig office and he was, you know, obviously quite a bit younger than I am. And when we were chatting about how he was running his business and how he was starting to scale Facebook, and they were still really small back then, he had so many questions and he was just so transparent about what he didn't know. And I always respected that. I'm like, wow, like, he's just telling me, like, you know, I always thought there was this kind of like a little bit of shame in admitting that you didn't know something. And I would say that in my 20s and early 30s, that was probably my biggest fault, was just not willing to admit to others and raise my hand and say, hey, I need some help here. And he was so good at that. So that was, you know, I just didn't have that in me for some reason. And some reason he had been coached to really embrace that, which I thought was awesome.
Moving on to our next question. Would you go in depth into your psilocybin experience?
Yes, happy to do so. So psilocybin is the magic component of magic mushrooms.
Not to be confused with Magic Mike.
That's right. Definitely not Magic Mike. A little different there. So psilocybin, I was curious about, because Tim Ferriss was telling me about it. And he was saying that there is a difference between a recreational dose and a high dose experience here. So just to give you some context, like people do, I've been with friends that have had mushrooms before, and I had eaten, actually in San Francisco, I'll never forget it. I had a chocolate that somebody gave me, and they go, oh, there's just a little bit of mushrooms in there, you'll have fun. And so I was like, okay. So I just ate the entire chocolate. Dude, I hate I hate when people don't tell you like the right dosing for things, you know,
yeah.
Like I ate the entire chocolate and I was in hell for like 5 hours. I basically, no one told me to go outside. So I was stuck inside.
Ooh,
and yeah, the set and setting wasn't right. And I felt like I was like hollowed out and I couldn't feel my heartbeat and I had a horrible anxiety. And it was the first time I had tried anything like that. And everything's moving. There's snakes in the carpet and like all this kind of shit. And I just had a horrible time. So I had a ton of anxiety. I'm like, I am never, ever, ever touching that again, period. And then, you know, jump forward another 15 years later, I'm talking to Tim and he's like, listen, like there's this high dose psilocybin thing where people go and you work with a guide. And it's not a thing where you just like giggle in the park. It's really doing deep work and they're, you know, doing it to cancer patients and people that are experiencing, you know, end of life situations where they want to be a little bit more at ease and at peace and people that have had PTSD. So people coming back from, you know, with wartime trauma and they're having great outcomes. And you can also apply this to other things like, you know, everyone has their whole onion layers of different traumatic events that we've all gone through. And mine was my dad. My dad had passed away and a lot of stuff was unsaid between the two of us. He was a very much do as I say, not as I do type father, very verbally just disrespectful of my mother, like verbally abusive for sure. Like it was a part of my family life every single day of my childhood. It was just a given thing that my dad would blow up, get upset, just trash my mom verbally. Never abusive in the physical, but you know, I would argue just as damaging, right? And it really wore my mom down on so many fronts. But my mom being the good, you know, Christian mom did not want to leave him because he wasn't cheating on her or anything like that. So, you know, that was a lot of kind of, I think I got a lot of just general anxiety around that stuff. And I would avoid confrontation and just a bunch of things that weren't good. So my dad passes away. I'm like, you know what? This sounds good. I'm going to go give this a shot. So I go meet with this person, husband and wife team. We sit down and we kind of whiteboard out the things that I want to go into. So you sit down and you're like, okay, well, I know I want to talk to my dad. I want to like find out why he was so angry. I want to find out what I'm still holding on to, blah, blah, blah. So we whiteboard all that out, set our intentions. So, you know, we burn some sage in the room, like it's a little bit of that action. And I down this like liquid version of psilocybin and sit down on the ground. You know, it takes 20, 30 minutes to kick in. Nothing's really happening. I'm just kind of talking. They're like, hey, let's do some stretching. I'm like, okay, I'm just stretching out a little bit. And, you know, everyone's kind of waiting for it to happen. And all of a sudden I'm just like the room just starts like popping in color and just like getting really intense, like where my hearing just becomes super crisp, but also overwhelming. Like it's turning on all these sensory things in my body that is, it's too much. It's like you're on a rocket ship and I don't know where the rocket ship is heading, but I've hit, you know, 3, 2, 1 has happened and we are at blast off. And so they're like, okay, well, and this is very much different than the you know, mushroom experience I'd had before because it's like a 5 gram dose. So it's like, you know, 5+ times the normal dose or more of what someone would do of a standard kind of like, you know, hanging out in the park dose.
That's a lot.
So it's a lot. It's a lot.
Had you ever done acid before this?
No, never done acid.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, well, they're like, let's lay down. So I laid down on the couch and they put some shades over me and like, you know, like a sleep mask type thing. And then all of a sudden, you know, I close my eyes and just these fractals come at me, just like these like beautiful fractals and all these like different kind of bending, kind of morphing and changing kind of psychedelic type, classic psychedelic type experience. And then that kind of passes. And then all of a sudden, a lot of this is hard to put into words, you know, cause it is such a feeling that you have that words just wouldn't do it justice. But I would say that the best way that I was able to traverse a little bit of my childhood and not so much the moment to moment, like a memory of something, but more like the feelings that had been layered on and stored in my body and in my brain. So I could feel these emotions, these really intense emotions. And I could see it was this combination of energy that had happened from my father being that abusive in that way. And I could like kind of like see it and like manipulate it a little bit and then just let it go. And when I was able to release it and let it go, I was just like, okay, I have the power to let this go. And I was started to like release and let go, release and let go. And then you come out of it. So then like, you know, you pop out for a second, take a sip of water. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And when I came out of it for the first time, my nose is just completely filled with snot. I have like tears just streaming. Like my shirt is drenched from tears. I'm like, whoa, what is going on? And like, you're sobbing. You're just releasing and letting go. And I'm not the first one to say this, but it's like so many people have said, it's like 10 years of therapy in a single session. And then you close your eyes and you go right back in. So the mask is back on, you're back in that world. And then I was able to see something that I'd forgotten, that was my mom had told me that my dad's dad was very verbally abusive. And so I could kind of see and feel the energy of my father and how that had come down from his dad and how it was passing down to me. And the beauty that struck me at that time was that this doesn't have to continue. I don't have to continue and let this energy pass down to my kids and to my wife. And seeing that I could release my father and my grandfather and take these emotions that they had put into me, but not act on them and let them go and pass them for them, was such an amazing, freeing feeling. And I felt like my father was so proud of me at that moment. And I felt like it was like this bonding I had with my dad that I was able to like let his energy pass through me. And we kind of merged as kind of spirits in some sense. I know this is sounding crazy if you've never done this, because I would have, when I've heard some of these stories too from friends of mine before I had done it, but it was such a great transformation for me. And when I came all out of this several hours later, I felt like there had been this huge burden that was lifted from me. And it was just like a fantastic experience.
It's fantastic because it let you break that cycle.
Yeah, 100%. And address it and really dig it up. You know, because it, you know, we all will experience anxieties and different things and little tics and things that happen. And sometimes you know where they come from, like, oh, I had a stressful day at work. And then other times you just don't know where it's coming from, right? You're like, why am I feeling like this? Where is this? Why is this building up? And I was able to go in and dig out a lot of that stuff that had been this kind of little background processes that were just running that I didn't, wasn't even at the subconscious level, and kind of flush those out and let those go. And my anxiety level just generally has dropped a ton and stayed with me. And gosh, it's been, I guess, 4 years since I had that experience, and I still experience those benefits to this day.
How long did the whole process take?
About 6 hours or so.
Whoa, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good. I mean, it's work. It's not fun. You know, yeah. When you're sitting there sobbing and revisiting the stuff and having conversations with your father and seeing the, you know, relationship with your wife and all the things that you want to go into, it's a lot of work.
How long did it take you to come down and recover from that?
You know, there's kind of this beautiful afterglow that lasts for a few days afterwards, and you sleep really well. And I would say that, you know, there was no kind of like druggy type feeling. It was very clear to me that this was like a natural substance that, you know, came from a mushroom, and I was back doing normal things the next morning.
If somebody wanted to do this, how do they go about it?
Well, first of all, I don't want to make any recommendations for people in terms of what dosage or anything like that to do. You need to work with a professional. And I would say Michael Pollan's latest book on psychedelics really goes into this topic in depth about how he was able to find a guide, kind of what he looked for in his guides. I would definitely say check out Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. And that will be, not only is it just great for that information, but he also covers a wide range of different psychedelics, many of which I've never tried. It's definitely my favorite go-to, that when people ask me about this, I always point them in that direction.
So let's get down to some tactical stuff. Would love to hear about your to-do system and how you manage work and life. And what does a typical day look like for you?
Yeah, so a typical day for me would be waking up at 7 a.m. I am on Zelda baby duty until the nanny shows up at 9. I don't eat any food initially, so I'll go in and I'll have either a cup of tea or just plain black coffee, feed the kiddo. do a little bit of kind of playing with the, you know, with the little one. And Daria, my wife, is working on the youngest one, trying to get her up. And so do a bunch of that stuff. And then when the nanny shows up, I'm able to go to work. And I have an office where I'm podcasting out of downstairs in my house here in Portland, Oregon. For me, every day is a little bit different. So I do receive a lot of pitches. So I'm a, you know, full-time venture capitalist at True Ventures. We look at early stage startups and kind of seed and Series A startups. You know, like I mentioned before, my interests are along the kind of longevity and biohacking side, also consumer internet. I looked at a lot of the cryptocurrency related stuff. So, you know, deals will either get sent to me internally to check out or referred to by other entrepreneurs. And then it's doing meetings. Like, you know, just before this call, I did a meeting with the founder, and we went in depth about his product, what he's trying to do, how much money he's looking to raise, things like that. And then I would say I continue to stay fasted. If I don't, I always try to get in some type of gym activity. So I don't have enough time to do like full gym sessions. So for me, it is cardio and sauna most days. And then I'll try and do weight training 3 days a week. These are kind of non-negotiable. I don't move them. I always make time for this. And it's nice when you really don't eat breakfast that you do find some extra time there. So I'll go and do cardio. It's pretty awesome. I'll do a 15 degree incline, which is really steep. It's the max that most treadmills go. And I'll walk at 1.6, and then I'll have an iPad as well. So that means I can listen to an audiobook, or I can go and actually do some work or emails if I need to. But after about an hour, which is what I aim for, I'm drenched in sweat. And I look at my Apple Watch and I've burned about 350 calories, and it's great. And then I'll jump into the sauna and do a 20-minute sauna session, just because all the data that around sauna usage points to 20 minutes being kind of the sweet spot at around 174 degrees Fahrenheit. I do mine at 180, and then I'll take a quick shower. And then by that time, it's normally like one something. I typically have hit my 16 or 18 hour window for fasting. I'll then have a vegetarian or vegan lunch. And then I am not vegetarian or vegan, but I always just try and do that. And then when it comes to dinner, I will do more kind of, you know, meat-based proteins, things like that. And then I come back to my computer, and some of the work that I have to do is around either podcasting, or it has to do with research in general. So just, you know, paying attention to all the trends, reading all the latest cryptocurrency news, and just seeing what's going on. So it's visiting sites like TechMeme, and just really kind of keeping a pulse on everything that kind of holistically in the tech industry, what's happening. So just understanding all of the different areas. There's some that I avoid. I don't really care a lot about the B2B kind of enterprise world, so I don't track that closely. But if it's consumer facing, there's a good chance if you talk to me in the afternoon and there was some big story, I'm pretty well read up on it, so that I'm just always keeping up with that stuff. And then, you know, when it hits 5 o'clock, I try to bounce out. My daughter's up for another couple hours, and so I spend some time with her, both of the daughters, and then, you know, we'll do bedtime routine and bath and things like that. And then, yeah, after that, dinner with my wife, try to do an early dinner so I can start the fasting early, and just the data around eating an early dinner leads to better night's sleep is great. Try to not drink too much alcohol. You know, for me, a couple glasses of wine is plenty. If I go above and beyond that, it's always a crapshoot in terms of how I'm going to sleep. I know, Jason, you and I have traded biohacking supplements and things for that. Oh, I didn't mention any of my supplements. I think we have a question about supplements coming up later, though, so I can go into that later. But that's a typical day.
What's your favorite tea, and would you ever go caffeine free?
Favorite tea? I will say that I'm drinking a lot of Japanese senchas now. I like the really grassy green teas. So if you can find a high quality organic Japanese sencha, that's probably your best bet. I don't have any places to recommend in that. Sadly, I actually go to Japan at least once a year, and I always get my whole fill when I'm out there. I always bring back a little miniature backpack worth of tea when I'm coming back. So I don't have a place to recommend. That said, if you want oolong teas, Red Blossom Tea based out of San Francisco, they sell online. By far the best importer of really high quality oolongs that are out there. They also do some green teas as well, mostly Chinese though, which are fantastic. And they're sourcing really high quality tea. In terms of matcha tea, I'm an investor with Dr. Andrew Weil and matcha.com. Andy is a really good friend, and he travels out to Japan and buys the absolute best matcha on earth, like the ceremonial grade matcha from very small tea producers. So not industrial grown matcha done the right way, like using ancient techniques. Like, this is legit stuff. It's expensive, but without a doubt, matcha.com has the best matcha, which if you want to consume the entire plant, which has a lot of health benefits, that's the way to do it. And I obviously get my matcha from there. So would I go caffeine free? I'm going to try it. Actually, I'm going to try it in January. I'm going to go completely caffeine free for 1 month and just see what happens to my sleep, just as a little hack. I'm going to have to taper off though. I have a feeling.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Cause I'm worried about headaches and all the other stuff. So
yeah, it's easy to do. You can do it like over the course of even a week is a long time to do it. I've been off of caffeine for 3 months and I just got back on it, and it took me about a week to get off it. And I skipped all of the headaches. Every day I would, for my tea in the morning, I would just knock down the caffeine level till it was basically at zero. And then I would have some herbal tea just so I still had my tea.
Yeah.
And you know, just the physical part of making the tea and going through it, so you don't lose that. And then I just stuck with herbal teas for 3 months and just went back on it. So I have faith that you can do it.
So have you noticed that your sleep has improved?
No.
So it didn't improve when you were doing no caffeine?
No, I found zero benefits for being off of caffeine.
Then, yeah, get back in.
That's what I mean. It's like, okay, the mornings were harder. I definitely found the mornings harder. It's like, I like to get up and go to the gym and get all my stuff done, because I get up at 4 a.m. and I like to have that boost at 5, because I always wait an hour before caffeine. And I found when that was gone, it just made the mornings so much harder. Even if I woke up perfectly, because I have an 8-sleep bed that tracks my sleep, and I get sleep reports from it, I'm sleeping fine. There was no change in my sleep whatsoever. And I just found that the mornings were actually harder. Hmm. So I said, screw it, and went back on it.
You know, what's crazy is I had heard recently a guest that I had my show. I'm sure you remember, Matt Walker. I forgot to mention that you also edit all my podcasts. So people should know that as well. So Matt Walker, he was talking recently that it turns out, obviously, caffeine has a benefit in terms of alertness and kind of waking you up and getting you going. But one of the reasons that people wake up in the morning, or they have, like, historically, has been that especially when you're sleeping outdoors, when things start to warm up, when your body starts to warm up, you kind of naturally rise. And one of the benefits of having a hot beverage, even if it's just decaffeinated tea, in the morning is it kind of warms you up internally, which will get things kind of firing up and starting to function and ramp back up in terms of, you know, your different like levels of hormones and a whole slew of different things. So it looks to be that obviously caffeine is going to be the go-to winner in terms of, you know, best bang for your buck in terms of getting that jolt. But if you're just looking for a little extra wake up, you could just have an herbal tea and the warmth will help as well.
It does do that. I have a feeling that my sleep didn't change because, like I said, I have an 8-sleep bed. So when I go to bed at night, the bed is cold. And like about an hour before I start to wake up, it actually warms the bed up.
Right.
And warms my body up. So when it comes time to wake up, I'm already warm and ready to go.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that thing is so good, man. It is so good.
I have a chili pad that does the same thing. So with mine, I can dial in exactly what temperature I want it at any point in the night.
Yeah.
And so I have it ramp up before I go to bed. And like when I get in bed, it's nice and warm. And then it goes all the way down to where I'm going to get the most deep sleep. And then it ramps me back up just before I wake up in the morning. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. That is the way to go. I mean, you haven't lived until you have one of these things.
Yeah.
I tell you.
They're amazing. They're not cheap, but it's like, you know, sleep is so important. Definitely worth the investment.
Yeah. Just the extra productivity you get back from not being groggy and crappy in the morning, you will earn it back, you know, in no time. And also for a lot of these things, you can turn off your house AC in the summer and you actually save electricity because you don't have to cool the whole house because you can just cool your bed.
Yeah.
And just have your heater turn on like when you get up in the morning or your AC turn on.
That's a great point.
So you can save a lot of money either way.
That's awesome. Yeah. These are awesome devices. Are you a fan of that bed? Cause I haven't used that bed yet.
Oh, I love it. I actually have two. I went and bought another one.
So it's the mattress, right? It's a full on mattress.
It's basically a memory foam mattress and the unit wraps around it. So you've got kind of this like waffle coil that is kind of attached to the bed. So it's probably like yours as well. It's just a lot of water tubing and piping with a little unit next to it with a, you know, a heater and a cooler next to it.
And what's it called again?
The Pod by 8 Sleep is the one I have.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah.
I'll check it out.
They're amazing. So we were talking about supplements before. We have a supplement question. What Lion's Mane supplement do you use?
Yeah, so Lion's Mane mushroom, really good for cognition. I typically, well, I'm growing them in my backyard, although they haven't come out yet this fall. So it probably would be springtime when I actually get some to pop out of the logs. But if I can't find them locally, and I oftentimes can because being in the Pacific Northwest, if you do ever find Lion's Mane in the grocery store, you can find them at more like the Whole Foods style stores. Just cut it up into thin, like quarter inch kind of like slices. You can dry roast it, meaning no oil. And then it'll get all of the, you just put it in a pan and it'll kind of just shrink down a bit because all of the natural water kind of just evaporates. Then you can add some oil or butter and a little bit of garlic and salt and pepper, and it ends up tasting like lobster. It's amazing. So,
oh man, really, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's really good, really healthy mushroom for you. So if I can't do that, there's a company called Real Mushrooms, which I had communicated with the founder a whole slew of different times, and they were also analyzed recently at a website that I really trust called Consumer Lab. That basically, Consumer Lab is a really awesome little hidden website that they are an independent third-party lab that comes in and they look at pretty much everything in terms of, like, you know, everything from vitamin supplements to protein powders to you name it, mushroom supplements. And then they come back and say, these are the ones that are most pure. These ones contain, you know, lead, or they don't. So they're looking at all the integrity of the product. So I've learned a lot there on which brands to avoid and which ones, you know, actually contain. A lot of the times it's not even bad things. It's just like they're reporting 500 milligrams in the bottle and it's only 220, you know, like little things like that, that you should be aware of. Just cause this is such an unregulated industry. But anyway, Real Mushrooms is the name of the brand. They sell on Amazon. I've talked to the founder a bunch. He's shared with me photos. And like I said, they were analyzed recently and it came out really positive. And so they're using the entire mushroom. So a lot of these brands that you have to be, I don't know, some people claim that a lot of the benefits actually happen in the fruit body, which is like the main kind of sprouting piece of it. And then other people claim that it's actually in the mycelium, which is the stuff that you really can't see, where a lot of this happens, like, you know, at the base of the actual mushroom. And I would say that I am torn in the science that I've looked at. So for me, I want to have something that has both. And Real Mushrooms does both. They give you the mycelium and the fruit body all combined in one. You're getting the full spectrum, which is always a good thing. So that's why I use them.
And what other supplements are you currently taking?
So I take a prescription supplement called metformin. It helps regulate glucose levels, but it has been linked to reducing the risk of a whole slew of different cancers and extending life in humans, which is amazing. So I take a gram of metformin a day, the extended release. Obviously, you have to get that through your doctor and talk to them about all that good stuff. I also take, I know that because of my genetic polymorphisms, you know, I've taken my 23andMe stats. You can actually, if you do a genetic test at 23andMe, you can export that data and you can take it into some third-party tools to analyze that data and then tell you, based on your genes, which supplements you should potentially be trying. And so I use Found My Fitness, Dr. Rhonda Patrick's website for that. You can take your export of 23andMe, drop it in there. She'll run a report and then you'll understand at least what you should be paying attention to. So for me, I'm a poor absorber of choline. So that means I need to eat more things like egg yolk and sometimes supplement with choline as well. And also I realize that I have the MTHFR genetic mutation, which means that I am a poor absorber of B vitamins. So I need them in a methylated state, which means that I use the Mega Foods multivitamin, which I love. And it's formulated by someone called Dr. Lowdog. And she uses methylated vitamins in that food. So they're going to be more bioavailable for me. The beautiful thing about this stuff, though, is we're getting to the point where you go in, you take a look at your 23andMe and you're like, huh, okay, well, it says that I have this genetic mutation that could lead to higher homocysteine levels, which is known to be a bad thing for cardiovascular disease and dementia and things like that. Then you go, you get your blood work drawn and you look and you're like, oh, yep, sure enough, my homocysteine is much higher than it should be, which is, I'm telling you my exact case here. And then you're like, okay, well, according to Rhonda's report, I should be taking methylated folate and other B vitamins. So I go in, supplement with methylated folate and B vitamins. And after 3 months, go in, get your blood work done again. And you can see that my homocysteine has gone down. Other things that her report uncovered for me was like, I most likely have low vitamin D. And so I go and check my blood and sure enough, I have low vitamin D. So it's like this kind of cat and mouse game of, does this actually apply to me? Because sometimes you could have a genetic polymorphism and it doesn't actually show up in your blood. So it's not really an issue for you, even though you have it, because, you know, genes are turn out to be really complicated. And just because you have a polymorphism doesn't mean it's actually active. So what you do is you just look, use it as a template, then get the blood work done, then supplement, and then go back and kind of rinse and repeat and do that until you fix things. So that's been a big, big thing and a fun thing to do over the last 5 or so years is that process. Getting back to the last thing real quick, I'll hammer out the other things. I take creatine every day, about 1.5 grams of it, not because I want to be buff, but because of the brain benefits that it offers. I take a vitamin D, obviously, and with that, I take K2, which is important to get with your D. I take the Maltese. Let's see, I got the metformin down there, and I think that's pretty much about it. I do every once in a while take turmeric, like a couple times a week for inflammation. I don't do it every single day. And same thing with mushrooms. Some things like lion's mane, I pulse that stuff where I'm doing it, you know, randomly like a couple times a week. So it's not something I have to have in me every single day.
Those Dr. Low Dog vitamins are awesome. I take the Mega Food Multi for Men 40 Plus because I'm an old guy.
Yes.
And that thing's great. Also, their turmeric is really good. I think Dr. Weil was on your show and he recommended the Mega Food. I think it's turmeric for whole body.
Yes. Yes. I'm a fan of Mega Foods. I love that they really show you all of the farms that they get everything from. And you know, a multivitamin is good is I back in the day, I don't know if you remember multivitamins, but like, you know, you go and you buy one at just an average drugstore, they're most likely going to be 99.9% of the time, they're going to be synthetic vitamins. And when you take those, you get that really horrible nausea. You ever taken a vitamin on an empty stomach?
Dude, like the old Centrums, yes. Those things would make me sick, yes, for like half the day.
I know, it was brutal. So basically, these were made from whole food ingredients and I can take them on an empty stomach with no nausea whatsoever. And they're just an awesome company. I have no affiliation with vitamin companies. None of these things that I'm mentioning today, I have any type of financial affiliation other than that matcha.com, which I already mentioned. But, yeah, so I just love that they produce a high quality product.
Moving on to some tech. Can you please explain how you go about buying Bitcoin or other crypto in small amounts?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple great places to do it. I would say the three that come to mind are obviously Coinbase is the biggest one out there. And they're going to have most of the kind of major cryptocurrencies that are out there. And so you can buy very small amounts of Bitcoin, you know, fractional coins right there. And then you can send them to a vault there, which kind of takes them offline. So there's no worry about them being hacked or anything like that. So if they were ever breached, like your coins are actually stored offline and completely safe. I like Coinbase for most things. I would say that does require, you know, setting up an account and then how do you get money in there and all that good stuff. If you're just looking to play around, Square actually has a fantastic app, the Square Cash app, and they allow you to buy Bitcoin directly inside of there. So I've had some friends where you're sitting at a dinner table and you're splitting up a bill and you're like, okay, well, here's $50. You send them Square Cash and then they just go and just like instantly convert it over to Bitcoin directly inside of the Square Cash app. I really love the work that Square is doing. I think Jack is really doing a great job at embracing cryptocurrency and also kind of providing an avenue for, you know, all of the unbanked people out there that don't have bank accounts. Let's just say, for example, every once in a while we get a babysitter to watch the kids. We pay our babysitters with Square Cash. They can then in like 2 seconds, just get a debit card from Square and they have instant access to their cash. They don't have to have a bank account or anything like that. So it's a pretty cool world and tool that Square has built.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, it's awesome. And also another stock trading one that does free stock trades, although Square is going to do that now too. But Robinhood is another one that does Bitcoin related stuff.
Next question. I'm turning 30. Yikes. Any advice on how to make the most of the next decade?
Yeah, this is a great one. I think you and I got off to a rough start in our early 30s. I wish we had been listening to a podcast like this or something.
Yeah, stop drinking now.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great one. There you go. Boom. End of show.
Yeah.
No, that's a huge one. Obviously, take your health seriously. Also, I would say now is the time to find and plug your gaps and admit to the gaps that you have. Like if you can't, I don't know, if you can't spell worse shit, like now's the time to go and figure that stuff out. If you don't know Excel, like now's the time to take a class on it. You know, you'll know where these areas are, like especially if you want to be an entrepreneur, like you've never built a P&L or you don't know anything about bookkeeping. Like it's a great time where your brain is still really still sponge-like and you can go in and learn these things. I would say that obviously it's never too late for any of this stuff, but in your early 30s is a great time to say, okay, I'm entering the serious stage of my career. I'm kind of starting to figure things out. Let's fill those gaps. And now you can step into bigger and bigger roles, whether it's starting something on your own or, you know, kind of working your way up a certain organization.
I would also say, don't fall victim to the sunk cost fallacy.
Yes.
If you're in a place that you kind of don't like, just cut bait and run, because I stayed in tech for probably 10 years longer than I should have. And it wasn't making me happy anymore. And now for the past 7 years, I did something completely different. I'm in podcasting now. I talk into a microphone all day, night and day from programming. And I have never been happier. And I wish I would have made that change years before I did. So just don't hold on to things because you've got an investment in them. Look for things that are going to make you happy.
Yeah. Jason, that's solid, solid advice. Like I should have mentioned that as well. There's so many people that they get to this point in their life and they're like, wow, I spent all my days in college going down this path. And, you know, I've put the last like 5-7 years into this career. And it's like, you'll know internally at this point, right? When you're 30, you know, is this something I want to spend the rest of my life doing? And if it's not, like you said, cut bait and move on. It now's the time, you know?
All right, we're coming to the end here, so we're going to do some rapid fires. First up, what guest has had the biggest impact on your everyday life?
Yeah, so Matt Walker, for sure. If that is my most popular episode of the podcast, it still continues to grow. People are passing it around. It's all about sleep and the importance of sleep. And so if you don't take sleep seriously or you haven't heard this episode, go back, check out the Matt Walker podcast on my show. I think you'll really enjoy it.
What are your current favorite biohacking tools?
Sauna, cold exposure, continuous glucose monitor. Those are the three. If you want to learn about the benefits of sauna and cold exposure, type in sauna, Rhonda Patrick PDF, and she has a great article both on sauna and cold exposure. So two separate documents. You can pull them up. She references all of the peer-reviewed science and why it's so important to figure out a way to incorporate this stuff into your life. So those are my go-tos.
If you had to choose just one, would it be Peloton or sauna?
Oof, that's a tough one. I would say probably Peloton, because I lost the most weight and got in better cardiovascular shape with Peloton, and it's a ton of fun. But that said, there are some really inexpensive ways to kind of like hack the sauna, some little single person saunas and these little things that kind of wrap around a chair and get you to the right temperatures. So don't think just because you drop a couple grand on a Peloton that, you know, you have to do the same thing for a sauna. There are much more inexpensive ways, infrared saunas, things like that as well. So, you know, I'd say do one and save up for the other.
Do you still invest?
I do. Yeah, I do. So I'm pretty vanilla when it comes to public market stuff, in that I do index funds, all the John Bogle Vanguard style stuff. And then a certain percentage of my net worth is carved out to cryptocurrency. So I'm really long on Bitcoin. So I hold a bunch of Bitcoin and a few other little smaller crypto projects. I know that when I say that, 1,000 people are going to be like, which ones? Gosh, I would have to think of the ones that, I'm holding some Filecoin from back in the day and a couple other ones that Solana is another one, S-O-L-A-N-A. I'm not saying buy these, I'm just telling you what I have.
Are you going long on Whopper Coin?
I don't know Whopper Coin.
Whopper Coin was the Burger King crypto.
Amazing.
That they put
out. Yeah, I never got into the Whopper Coin. But yeah, so investing wise, I tend to think go super risky with a very small percentage of your net worth. So for me, that's crypto and tech investing. And then the rest is like just not going to lose it, going to get me, you know, nice little slow gains year over year.
How many meals a day do you eat?
Two. Lunch and dinner.
Easy enough. How do you balance exploring your many interests with being a present husband and father?
It's really difficult. I would say that I used to do like 10 little small things that I was always like juggling. And now I pick like one thing that I want to go and consider to be an outside of work activity. And then I just go do that. So for example, I've been doing actually kind of two birds, one stone. I wanted to spend time with my mom and get to spend some time with her. She lives here as well. And she's getting up there. She'll be 80 next year, which is crazy. So I am taking a pottery class with my mom right now. And I do that once a week. And I've always wanted to take some pottery and learn and just try my hand at that. So it's like, I get to spend time with mom and do pottery. So it's awesome. But yeah, just picking one thing, because they kind of hit on it with a question, but it is hard to juggle everything.
What's your thought process behind moving to Portland? Good life investment?
Yeah, Portland's amazing. If you haven't been, a phenomenal place to visit. Hiking trails, beautiful forests, fantastic beer scene. It's almost too good of a beer scene, my gut will tell you. And you get a lot more. Like it's a lot more space, and it's still a really affordable place. And the food scene is awesome. I mean, there's just so much to love in terms of just like a really cool town. Certain areas they have these like fun little pocket neighborhoods with all these little coffee shops and a lot of rain, but you know, that's why you get the beautiful forests and the amazing summers.
How did you meet Daria, and when did you realize she was the one?
Met Daria on Twitter. She automatically followed me because I was a suggested user. Back in the suggested user list was hard coded. So I have to thank Ev for that one. He was the CEO at the time and added me to the suggested user list. I started getting all these followers all of a sudden. And then Daria happened to be one of them. And she retweeted something that I had tweeted. It was actually about Dr. Andrew Weil. And I was like, who's this little hot little 40x40 icon? I just like zoomed in on that and clicked on her profile, and we ended up meeting up for a bottle of wine. And I would say I knew she was the one when I found someone that was into Zelda, that was super geeky because she's a neuroscientist, you know, obviously really attractive and awesome. And also but really willing to work on herself and always be improving and treating our relationship like we're in this together versus, you know, confrontations with her, because it always obviously happens with everyone. We have always been, let's figure out a way to solve this. And then that we'll both want the same thing. We both want a healthy, loving relationship. And so working on this together versus it being me versus you is such a nice, refreshing way of approaching things. So just finding that in someone.
I got to say, you hit the lottery with that one, brother.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, she's awesome.
She is. How do you network with people, assuming you're starting from scratch?
Oh, that's a good question. So if you're starting from scratch, I would say meetups are your friend. Go to where you're going to find like-minded folks. Be yourself. Don't try. I mean, the second you try and be someone you're not, it's going to be so apparent. And then use actually the workplace for a lot of this. So just meeting people at the same company is a less intimidating thing to do. And, you know, just sitting at the lunch table with a different group of people, asking them about where they work. If you're at a big company, offering assistance and how you can help out in certain ways. I think would say that those are great places to start.
What's your favorite Japanese whiskey under $100?
Okay. So I was really glad to receive this question. It's a tricky question because there's no such thing. Japanese whiskeys are just insanely overpriced right now. I mean, you can get a horrible Japanese whiskey by some unknown brand, but don't do that. So the one I will tell you that I think is fantastic. You know, like that chocolate with like sea salt on it?
Oh, yeah.
You know that kind of like savory, sweet flavor profile?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
If you're a fan of that, Nika Yoichi makes a whiskey called the Peaty and Salty. And it's $289 a bottle.
Oh,
yeah, it's pricey. I get that. But you know, these things are not getting any cheaper. So it's like a little bit of investment. And I know it's really pricey, but you asked about Japanese whiskey. So like Japanese whiskeys are not cheap. Like just to give you some context here, you go and get, you know, a blended Hibiki and it's going to be like $800 a bottle plus, and it just gets crazier and crazier from there. So this is a killer bottle if you're willing to make the investment. And it has that components of like peatiness and saltiness that it's just a fun, nice little friend to sip on. But I buy Japanese whiskeys from a place called Decanta because you can really trust them. You can find cheaper places to find this probably, but it's like, I don't know that I would fully trust all the spots. So Decanta.com is my go-to place for, they're a great Japanese importer.
What's your favorite book of 2019?
I've got a few. I would say that The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer was fantastic. One thing that I did enjoy was this book called Buddha by Karen Armstrong. And it really is a biography of who was the Buddha. Like, you know, you hear these things like, okay, Buddha, religion, you know, there's all these books on how to meditate, how the Buddha did. But how about just like the human, the person? Where did he come from? What kind of household did he grow up in? What happened when he became enlightened? How did he gain his following? Like, just understanding and writing that story has been fascinating to read. And so, yeah, Buddha by Karen Armstrong is definitely a good one.
I've got one for you because I remember you and I both had a pretty bad fear of flying, which
gave into
a love of Bloody Marys at 7 a.m.
Yeah. Thanks for telling everybody that.
Well, there's a great book called Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel by Patrick Smith, who's a pilot. It came out in, I think, 2015. I get this book on Audible, and I just put, every time I go on a plane, I start listening to it on my way to the airport and can just skip around. I feel safer in a plane now than I do standing in the airport.
That's amazing.
It is unbelievable. This will get anybody over a fear of flying, I tell you, because he just goes through everything about what it's like to be a pilot, how safe being on the plane is, because statistically, that is the safest place in the airport. From the time you're in your house to when you're on that plane, everything in between is more dangerous than you actually being on that plane, even when it's on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I've been walking on through some of those little tunnels to get to the plane. You feel like those things are going to collapse on you.
I tell you, man.
I will say that I fly so much now that I've gotten over a lot of that. I think once you fly like 4 times a month, it doesn't really impact you as much. And then also doing a lot of the surrender stuff where like, there's a great course by Michael Singer on surrender. That one will really help out a lot. But yeah, I'm excited to read this. I'm definitely down, but that said, you know, if it's like 6 o'clock and I'm taking a later flight, I no longer have to do the morning Bloody Marys, but like definitely if I'm taking a later flight, I'm like, yeah, why not have a beer or something before I get on the plane.
So are you doing the Wim Hof method this winter?
I am. Yeah. I'm going to start in December. So stay tuned on Instagram at Kevin Rose and you'll see all of my crazy ice bath experiments. And I'll also kind of outline what the method's all about.
Do you have any fault or ailments like OCD or ADHD?
Oh man. Yeah, absolutely. I've always been someone that ruminates a lot on things. So I've always kind of had that issue where if something enters my head and I like will obsess over it in a way. I've talked to people about this and they won't classify it as OCD, but they've said that it's like a mild form of that where you're like, I guess it's like the fear of flying, right? Like if you have a fear of flying, you're just kind of, there's no logical reason to have that. You're just kind of ruminating on this idea that something might happen on the plane that you're on. And so that's been an issue of mine that I find that meditation helps a ton with. I would say that was kind of my biggest one. Also, I've had a really hard time ever since I was little with just memorizing things. I had some type of learning disability when I was younger and I was horrible at memorizing things, people's faces and names. And yeah, it's for some reason I was like the kid in class that just could not, you know, like my alphabet telling you which letters came before and after. I just remember like there being just issues with memory and recall. I think now that I look at my genetics, I think it's tied to the way that I absorb choline. So anyway, but it's just, yeah, I mean, we all got something, right?
Ain't that the truth?
What are yours? Give me your 30-second version. I know you must have some.
Oh, well, I'm dyslexic, which is real fun. Hate that part, especially when you're trying to read scripts all day long. I recommend the Open Dyslexia font, which is fantastic for people who have any kind of reading disability. It really helps form the words and you can see them. I wish you could put this font on everything. So between that codependency and a lot of you got a little OCD going on too.
Yeah.
I think everybody's got a sprinkle of something.
Yeah, for sure.
There's no such thing as normal, man.
That's right. Yeah, there is no such thing. Yeah. And it's always, I feel like the geekier you get too, like I'm a little bit of an introvert, like the more some of that stuff is apparent.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're an introvert, because when we met, we both were doing a lot of stuff where we had to be around a lot of other people. And I think both of us, that's why we like, you know, would kind of just run off and do other things, because we didn't want to be around those other people, like that many people. But I first saw you on TV. I saw you on Tech TV your first day, because I was a big Tech TV fan and I was working with Chris Perillo. And you wouldn't think somebody who was on TV doing all the talks that you were doing and also doing Dignation and all that stuff was an introvert. But I think that happens a lot for people like us in tech.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely remember the first time I was co-hosting the show on Tech TV. Leo and Patrick were out. They were off doing something, and it was myself and Martin. And I was like so nervous. He took me out. We did a shot before the show started, a shot of whiskey.
Always a great idea for live TV.
Yeah, always a great idea. But it's just like, you know, I had a really tough time. I would be done with the shows. I would just like be sweating. Like, you know, it's so intense to do live TV in front of that many people.
Oh yeah.
But it's like flying in that way. You do it enough times and all of a sudden it starts to get a lot easier. For me, the hardest thing has been that, and something I always enjoyed about our friendship is like, you know, we'd go have beers and we'd talk about real things. It wasn't this kind of like, you know, party talk that so many times people get into where you're like, what do you do? Like where, you know, and it was, I've always avoided that kind of like, just, I've never been good at it, I guess. Never been good at that. Just general,
like surface level stuff.
Yeah. Surface level stuff. And so I've always wanted to kind of get deeper pretty quickly. And, that's why I prefer smaller, more intimate groups, I think. And just meeting people for the first time and, you know, having to answer all those questions has always been awkward for me. I don't know.
Yeah. And I can imagine, I've only been on live TV once. I did my stint on Call for Help with Chris Perillo, and my hands were under the desk, like shaking before we went to air.
It's crazy.
As soon as the light went on, though, I got calm. It was weird. It's like, okay, boom, lights on, got to perform.
Yeah, and exactly.
As soon as the light went off, I like, you know, had a panic attack. I could turn it on for that 3 minutes when we were on the air. And then after it was done, it was like this like ton of bricks hit you.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's crazy. I used to get like these muscle twitching like in my leg randomly after live shows. It would just like, I'd go out and have a drink afterwards and I just like feel like this twitching from just like this stress, you know, just like these little tiny micro stress that was still kind of like the earthquake after it happened, all the little small, you know, like little tremors that were coming.
Yeah, that's like, I'm sure a lot of that's the adrenaline leaving your system too.
Oh, for sure.
All right, getting to the end here. Have you ever considered investing in a zombie movie? I have a script.
Yeah, I thought this one was funny to include because it just shows you like some of the, I have not considered investing, but thank you for offering.
You should start a podcast. Nobody needs a movie anymore.
That's right.
What are your favorite spots in Portland?
Yeah, so if you're going to come out to Portland, definitely on the food side, Ox, fantastic Uruguayan beef there, amazing bone marrow like stews, and they actually have a really good beef heart dish that is with horseradish on top of it that is unbelievably good. All this stuff's really funky, but it's so good for you. Tusk is another great one, kind of Mediterranean inspired, phenomenal hummus, really good spot. Sushi wise, we have a great sustainable sushi restaurant out here called Bamboo. Also, a fantastic, I would say, closest to Japan experience I've had in all of the United States would be a tasting menu called Nodoguro. So if you are out here visiting and you want to make sure to get reservations a month out, but Nodoguro is really the closest thing you'll get to an actual like Japanese experience, really legit chef that trained in Japan. Obviously, all the breweries are great. Deschutes Brewery is probably my favorite. If you want to try all of the crazy beers, because we have more microbrews out here per capita than any other place in the United States, go to a place called Loyal Legion. They have over, I think, 90 or 100 local beers on tap. And so you get to do these little tasting flights that are phenomenal. That's a fun, fun place. The Japanese Gardens are a great place to just hang out and see some of the most beautiful. In Tokyo, they call Portland their mother or their sister city. And that the Japanese gardens by many in Japan are considered to be the best in the United States are in Portland, Oregon. So definitely check that out. And of course, all of the hiking trails and all the cool stuff to do out here.
Well, that's it for the questions on this one. This was a blast. I'm going to have you on my podcast soon. It was fun getting to chat again.
Yeah. Jason, thanks so much for doing this. Awesome to have someone to bounce these ideas off of and go back and forth on. And your insights, of course, are always awesome. So it's great to have your commentary as well.
Anytime, brother. Anytime.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. That's it for this show. I hope you enjoyed it. But before I let you go, I want to tell you a little bit more about the Jordan Harbinger podcast.
So a lot of people ask me what other podcasts I listen to, and definitely top on my list, Jordan Harbinger Show. Jordan, you're on with me. Thanks for joining me for this quick little segment.
For sure, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you've had some crazy guests on your show, and I know you like to go really deep like I do when you have a guest on. It's not just bullet points and, you know, a variety show, but you actually get into their psyche. Talk to me about one of your favorite guests recently.
I had Jamie Metzl, and he's a tech futurist, and he's kind of a geopolitical expert as well as an entrepreneur. But this guy, he wrote a book called Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. And so, yeah, a lot of people are talking about gene editing and things like that, but this is kind of what happens in 100 years. And it's humans are disease resistant to things that right now you wouldn't even think about. And outlier traits in humanity, such as IQs of several hundred or even possibly up to 1,000, are things that we can then select for. So we might have humans that are designer bred. Everyone's 6'5", everyone's cancer resistant, everyone's disease resistant, everyone is super intelligent, things like that, super athletic, things like this. And he even discussed the idea that we might have certain breeds of human that are radiation resistant. And I thought, well, why do we need that? Well, if we're going to go to space and it's going to take us years in a spaceship to get to Mars or other planets even further away, we need to have people that aren't just going to immediately be cancer ridden by the time they get there or horribly sick. You can breed people that might be resistant to solar radiation and other types of radiation that are in, outside the atmosphere.
How about just the flight attendants?
Like, yeah,
we all get zapped. Attendants. I don't know if you know that. Like, yeah. We all get zapped every time you take a flight. It's pretty bad.
That's right. Yeah. Pilots are like, yeah, here's a pilot that can work for another 10 years and doesn't get a horrible, horrible form of cancer afterwards because he's in the sky all the time. So he's talking about these types of things. But how will this affect the gene pool? Will it start an arms race with genetics? Will it change corporations, governments, religion, crime? And he explores all of this. And of course, sports. I mean, that goes without saying. Sports are going to look totally different when everybody can just walk up to a basket, you know, or sprint at twice the speed of Usain Bolt and just slam the ball in. Everything is going to change. And so he was just absolutely fascinating. We did like a solid hour and change with Jamie Metzl on the show.
That's awesome. Well, I will link up that episode in our show notes and in the description of the podcast here so people can get it. If people want to go directly, I mean, obviously they can search for your show in their favorite podcast app, but where else can they find you online?
Sure. The Jordan Harbinger Show in any podcast app, like you said, at jordanharbinger.com as well. And yeah, I would love to hear what your audience thinks of this episode and the show in general, because smart people are what I'm looking for.
Yeah. I mean, you've had just like you bounce around in terms of like awesome guests. Like you can go with someone that's super obscure, but really interesting. And then you have people like Kobe Bryant on, which is just nuts. So I love the show. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
All right. That's it for this show. Please do me one last favor and head on over to where you found this podcast, normally in your favorite podcasting app or on the Apple Store, and rate us 5 stars. That would really help us get recommended to more people and have better guests on the show. Take care.